This edition of Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 13th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. It's Sunday the 13th of May 2012 and this is the Monocle Weekly, edition 149. With me, Steve Bloomfield, Sophie Grove and Jonathan Openshaw.
On the show today, we'll be joined by Ian Bremmer, the strategist with an eye on both politics and business, making him your go-to guy during these uncertain economic times.
We'll also be talking to AJ Jacobs, the writer committed to becoming the most healthy man on earth whilst having a few laughs doing it.
And later on, we'll chat to Kaya Seeker, editor of sardonic online news and commentary site The All, about his thoughts on gay marriage.
All that and, of course, some great music too, all in the next hour on the Monocle Weekly.
Happy Sunday morning, Sophie Grove.
Thank you.
Happy Sunday morning, Jonathan Openshaw.
Thank you very much.
It's nice being here.
Seeing you guys
right
again.
Back at you.
It's quite nice being in the Midori House on a Sunday morning. We've got orange juice. We've got we were going to have some croissants, but you know,
where's the croissants, Paul?
Well, it's Paul Noble, our producer, I think could have provided them, but yeah, no crumbs in the studio.
It's sort of church substitute, really, isn't it? This studio.
What, the Monocle Weekly?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. No, definitely. At this time on a Sunday morning, you have the option of going to church or of course, you know, sitting back on your favourite armchair or maybe on your sofa or maybe your kitchen table, having a light brunch and listening to the Monocle Weekly. I know which one I would choose.
It's nice for us as well, because we're normally desk buddies as well, up on the editorial floor. So having a whole 2 days without you would be a shame.
Exactly. We are used to sitting next to each other on what I like to call the foreign desk.
Which is not the foreign desk, because it's got the business editor on it.
Yeah, I know. But
foreign mixed.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is.
Hybrid.
the hybrid desk. Sophie, how was your week?
Oh, I loved it. Well,
aside from the weather, of course.
It rained solidly, and the highlight, or the low light rather, was when I went to the very north of this great city, London, to meet an architect and walk around Hampstead Garden suburbs for The Urbanist. And it was unbelievably chilly. We did the interview under an umbrella, kind of a golf umbrella. the real low point was when a massive van came by and just sprayed us with sort of muddy, freezing cold gutter water.
You should have put the umbrella down by your side.
Yes,
to sort of protect yourself.
Yeah, but then you get wet from above. And we went scurrying round in allotments, looking at people's rhubarb, and just sort of looked at this lovely sort of wonderful environment that was also a bit Stepford Wives, it has to be said.
I love it, reporting on suburbia so you don't have to. It's one of those things that you kind of tell your friends about, one of those assignments, and they're just like, and what do you do again? I've been in the garden suburbs for the day.
And the other bad thing about that experience for you was that it meant you missed out on a rather special Midori House Sessions, which was happening at exactly the same time here in Marylebone.
Such is life.
Yeah, yeah, pretty brilliant.
It was New Look,
which the name isn't great.
I know, it does make you think of like cheap clothes made in Bangladesh by 12-year-olds.
Peacocks in next week. But the band were phenomenal, incredible.
They were.
With that lead singer, she's amazing on a kind of...
You had a bit of a crush on her, didn't you?
Of course, you know me. A weakness for the Jessica Rabbit lookalikes. But no, very, very cool. Another great band that we've had on out of Canada.
Yes, yeah, I mean, that was their only downside, they are Canadian. But they were, not only was the lead singer very cool and Jessica Rabbit-esque, but also they had the other part of the duo. Was a man who I think looks like the guy from Erasure, who's not Andy Bell.
Which no one else sees.
Vince Thingamajig, Vince Clark. I've just been told by our producer. Vince Clark. And because, you know, he stands at the back and twiddles with some knobs and wears some sunglasses and doesn't do much else.
Steve, you're the foreign editor and it shows.
A bit harsh. Fine. No, fine. Let's move on. Let's move on. Ian Bremmer is standing right outside Studio One, sort of ready and waiting to come in. Should we let him in?
Let's.
Okay, let's, right after this. Ian Bremmer is a political strategist whose deep understanding of American foreign policy commands respect from his fellow academics at Columbia University. Did you write this yourself, Ian?
I did.
Oh, excellent, good. It also means he's in demand from big businesses, eager to know how the latest political bombshell, or real bombs for that matter, might affect the future economic landscape. His new book, Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World, looks at both the up and downsides of a world lacking in popular leaders. Ian, welcome to Monocle 24.
Great to be with you guys.
Thank you very much for coming. Let's start with the obvious question for anyone who doesn't, who's not familiar with your writing. What is a G0 world?
Well, you've heard of the G20, perhaps. This the notion that the world's 20 largest economies are going to get together and provide some form of global leadership. That is aspirational, but it's not actually happening. After World War II, in various manifestations, the United States, with its allies, you know, really led the global economy and the global institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, Bretton Woods Accord on Currency, the United Nations Security Council, you name it. After 2008, that no longer functioned. And what we have to replace it is a vacuum. It's a lack of global leadership. The U.S. is less willing to do the kind of lifting it has historically. And you see this in whether you talk about Europe and the bailout or whether you talk about Iraq or Afghanistan. But no other countries are prepared or capable to step into that void. And hence, we have a G0. It's a very different kind of world we're living in.
I mean, there's an argument that, you know, the UN Security Council is still run by the same five powers it was run by in 1948. The Bretton Woods system is still run by the same people we've just seen recently. A minor hoo-ha over who's going to run the World Bank, but at the end of the day, it's an American again. So, I mean, those major powers are still running those institutions, are they not?
You're certainly right that the institutions haven't actually changed that much, but the willingness of the leader of those institutions, the United States, to project the kind of power it has historically is very different. Again, you look at the European financial crisis, for example. Geithner is more than willing to jet into Europe and dispense advice, but he's not going to write any checks. And when Sarkozy, now not president anymore, but when he was president, he went to Hu Jintao and said, well, how about some support from you guys? They said, well, we'd like to do it multilaterally, which is Chinese for no. So let's be clear. No one is going to bail out the Europeans other than Europe. There is no Marshall Plan on the agenda, and no one's going to remove Bashar Assad from power in Syria. And we can keep going. It's a very different world environment, though the institutions have adapted very little.
But what does that mean then in practice when there are no leaders, there is no one to, you know, to lead the world, as it were?
There are a couple things it means in practice. The first is that conflicts grow. It means there's much more volatility and risk in the world. But it also means that you are not trying to adapt yourselves to a process of U.S.-led globalization to do well. You're trying to hedge because there are many different local powers that have very different ideas of how they wish you to behave. And so as a country or a company, you need to be much more flexible. You need to be able to effectively pivot between, let's say, the U.S. and China if you're in Asia. You need to pivot between the Europeans, the Middle East, and Asia, if you're a country like Turkey. Some countries do that really well, others don't. And in a G0 environment, that's going to be critical.
You mentioned China there, and obviously if we're talking about economics, all eyes are on the East, all eyes on what China's doing. Why is that not quite the case with geopolitics? And why is it that China seems so reluctant to kind of exert their political might in the way that they're very happy to with their economic might?
Well, internationally, China is the Voldemort of geopolitical foes, right? They're the name that must not be spoken. Everyone knows that they're the country that you have the big problem with if you're the United States, but you really don't want to make a big deal out of it because it could get even worse. So as a consequence, we say Russia, we say Al-Qaeda. That is a big part of it in the United States. The money is being spent on trying to defend against cybersecurity and Chinese military growth. Certainly the U.S. pivot towards Asia with its allies is meant to contain China if China doesn't behave the way the Americans want to. But the other side of that question that you ask is, what about China itself? Why isn't China going to take the kind of initiatives, the kind of steps that the Americans historically have? And the answer is very simple. They're a poor country. And when China becomes the world's largest economy, as it will in the next 5, 10, 20 years, they will remain a poor country. And that means that they have very little interest in tackling climate, even to the limited degree that the Americans have historically been willing to. They won't be interested in providing, in being the world's policeman, whether you're talking about piracy, safe passage of seas, or limiting nuclear proliferation or all the rest. They're focused radically more on their own domestic political stability. And that's just, it's such a different kind of world we'll be looking at when the world's largest economy is a poor country.
And I wanted to say, you know, you're talking about moral intervention in some respects, but also part of your book is about what would happen if there was a global catastrophe. Who would step up to the plate, as it were, and take leadership then? Who do you think would sort of lead the world if there was something, you know, absolutely catastrophic that happened?
Well, it's funny, you know, newly elected President Putin, again, yesterday just came out and reminded everyone of World War II, when the United States was very slow to step in, and as a consequence, there was much more of an international catastrophe than there otherwise would have been. In some ways, the clock is being dialed back. The world that we are seeing looks a little bit more like that pre-World War II environment because the United States is not prepared to play the sort of leadership, even though it can. I mean, if the U.S. wanted to bail out Europe, even with its deficit issues, it could provide money. The U.S. could remove Assad from power in Syria. The U.S. could take the lead in bombing Iran and not have everyone worrying that the Israelis are going to do it. I'm not suggesting these are all good things to do. I'm simply saying the U.S. has the capacity to do it, but they're not going to. The American people don't want them to. They want those troops out of Afghanistan. Obama just went, did that deal with Karzai. You didn't see much criticism even from the Republicans, because in the United States, you have a lot of Americans that are saying, wow, you're not going to fix New Orleans after Katrina. Why should we fix Afghanistan? Why don't we bring our soldiers home? Why are we spending this money? It's going to be hard to get through that. But if the worst were to come, then certainly the world's largest economy and the world's largest military would still ultimately intervene. The question is, how long does it take to get to ultimately?
And we're going to take a brief pause, a musical pause, if you like. This is The Stylistics with People Make the World Go Round. That was The Stylistics with People Make the World Go Round. You're back with The Monocle Weekly, with me, Steve Bloomfield, with Jonathan Openshaw, with Sophie Grove, and also with Ian Bremmer, author of Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World. And also, worth mentioning, you're the president of the Eurasia Group.
I am.
Yeah, there we are. I just thought I'd mention that.
Cheers.
You
mentioned my socks match today. I mean, come on.
You want us to talk about your socks as well?
No, you don't have to. It's okay.
No, it's
here at Monaco.
Ian came in, he made a big play of sort of pointing out his very stripy socks. Can we see them again?
You certainly may.
I missed what colour they were.
They're amazing blue and sort of lime green.
Well, that sort of looks like mustard from here to me.
Chartreuse, definitely.
Okay.
But I mean, you know, I'm noticing that everyone else here does have socks that match, and I know it's important, so I made an effort this morning. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. We're very glad that you made an effort. we're going to segue seamlessly from a discussion about socks to, you know, global geopolitics. Is part of the problem at the moment that essentially no one really wants to run the world? Yeah, there's been, you look through history, there's always been a time where someone wanted to run the world and another country kind of wanted to run it instead. Whereas now we've seen in Europe, Germany doesn't really want to take on a leadership role. You said yourself with the US, the US doesn't really want to take a global leadership role. China certainly doesn't. Is that our problem right now?
I think that is certainly a very big part of it. And, you know, if you look around the world, there are plenty of countries that actually want to have an enormous amount of say over their own countries and over their neighborhoods. Russia, absolutely. wants everyone getting their nose out of their business in places like Ukraine or Belarus or Georgia. The Chinese absolutely feel the same way about, say, the East China Sea, the South China Sea, their local neighborhood. That's very different from problems and challenges that are broader than that. And if the United States is not going to do that lifting, if we're not going to pull our socks up, then nobody else is.
Is that necessarily a problem, though? I mean, if you have, you know, regional groupings that sort of try to muddle through their own separate issues, that you have, you know, ad hoc coalitions, coalitions of the willing, to pluck a phrase, you know, is that necessarily a problem rather than relying on the structures that have been in place for a while?
Well, it's a problem in two ways. The first way it's a problem is that some challenges are by their nature intrinsically global. Climate is obvious in this regard. Trade, if you don't have a global agreement on trade and you end up with local agreements on trade, it's much less efficient. You get much less growth. That is certainly a less propitious environment, not only for people around the world, but, say, for multinational corporations in the private sector in terms of wealth generation. But there's another way it's problematic, too, and that's that these regions don't run the same way. Europe is, of course, mostly voluntary in terms of its integration. It's about shared political and economic values. Again, not all the time, but mostly. And it's institutionalized. You go to Eurasia, it's not that way. It's much more coercive. It's about energy and security relations towards Russia. It's much less formal. In the Middle East, it's actually much more sectarian. You want to look at the problem that happens when you let every nation rule for itself. In the Middle East, you've got Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Turkey. They're the major players, and they support completely different people. The Saudis support the Sunnis and Arab monarchies, and the Iranians support the Shia, who are largely disenfranchised. And the Turks, to the extent that they support anyone, it's much more the urban middle classes, the more secularized elites. Well, that's all great, but if they're all playing in this field, that's going to cause this region to break apart. And it's one of the reasons why, looking now over a year after the Arab Spring commenced, the only country across that entire part of the world that has a definably positive trajectory is Tunisia. Great for Tunisia. It's a tiny little country. This is really bad for the Middle East.
I was just wondering as well, I mean, are there also opportunities that come out of a G0 situation? If you look at the world of business, we talk, you know, people really familiar with ideas of creative destruction. If an industry comes apart at the seams, then actually there's opportunities in that as well. So where a new system can emerge that's maybe more relevant, more robust. Perhaps it's what the music industry is going through at the moment, and maybe that's more destruction than creative at the moment. But can the same be applied to geopolitics? Can there be creative destruction, and can something new and more perhaps more relevant rise out of the ashes of an old system?
I think this is creative destruction in the geopolitical space. And the reason it's scary to us is because, unlike in the business environment where it happens all the time, it rarely happens on the global stage. The last time it happened was World War II. Now, the reason it has occurred is because the institutions, as you mentioned at the outset, haven't changed. They're still all U.S.-led, but the underlying balance of power has shifted dramatically in the last 30 years from the United States towards China, from the developed world towards the developing world, from debtor nations towards creditor nations. So clearly, at some point, that was going to break. And it took the 2008 financial crisis for it to hit. The optimistic way of looking at this is, thank God it happened in 2008 and not in 2018 or 2018, when the underlying balance of power would be so far out of whack that the ability of rich states to play a significant role in what comes next would be much more undermined. We do have an opportunity, and that opportunity is to create new architecture, new institutional framework, new leadership that more accurately reflects the world order we presently have, and that, of course, will function much more effectively.
Do you think that China will eventually have to face the fact that it will need to lead the world in some respects, and it will have to find a sort of moral compass at some point, just because they're going to have so much investment, for instance, in Africa at the moment? You know, there's so much money going in there, and they haven't actually said, you know, we support democracy or anything like that, of course. But will they have to, just for the sake of stability?
Well, they have to get the China stability question right before they get the global stability question right. And that is going to be the most important issue for us to address over the next 10 to 20 years. For China to continue to grow and therefore ensure the viability of their government, their regime, they must fundamentally restructure their economy as a whole. They can't be doing low-cost manufacturing for export to the West. They must move towards a consumer-led economy. That means ripping apart the system of state capitalism that actually supports the wealth of all of the key leaders that presently run that country. That they know they need to do it. That's the good thing about China, is they've actually diagnosed the problem, just as the World Bank has. But diagnosing it and actually going and handling the treatment is a very different story. Right now, they're not set up to do that. And so my answer to you is no time soon. For the next 5 years, we will be consumed with questions about whether or not the Chinese will be able to actually effectively restructure their own economic and political system. And that's well before they'll start thinking constructively about being what the Americans would call a responsible stakeholder.
We're going to pause again just for a moment right there. You're listening to Michael Weekly. When we come back, we're going to have more from Ian Bremmer.
From 8 a.m. London time and 9 a.m. Central European time every weekday, Monocle 24 presents The Continental Shift. Our editors guide you through 4 hours of hand-picked music, from Danish ballads to German electro-pop and beyond. Plus all the headlines from the European papers, regular check-ins with our correspondents and editors, and the news bulletin at the top of the hour. That's The Continental Shift, right here on Monocle 24.
The Urbanist is the show about the cities we live in. From mayors to street sweepers, from the CBD to the suburbs, this is the show that takes you to the heart of your metropolis. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we speak to the planners, thinkers, and politicians changing the urban world. On this episode of The Urbanist, we reverse our commute and head out to the suburbs. From Sydney's sprawl to the City of Surrey's new CBD, we look at the good, the bad, and the brand new of living on the outskirts. And let's not forget the leafy and lofty 20th century ideals of London's Hampstead Garden suburb.
This would be very, very useful if you were in a guerrilla war, because it feels very secret, very enclosed, but the residents keep the hedges very well trimmed.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
I love the little bring-bring at the end of the Urbanist promo. It's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like somebody's come part of their Pashley bicycle.
It's exactly what Andrew Tuck does
Yeah. Every
week on The Urbanist. You're back with The Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, with Sophie Grove, with Jonathan Openshaw, and also in the studio with Ian Bremmer, author of Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World. And Ian, as we mentioned earlier, you're also president of the Eurasia Group, a political risk consultancy. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what your day-to-day work is actually like, you know, the sorts of people and organisations that you're advising. I mean, who is it that sort of, you know, comes and knocks on your door?
It's a lot of folks. We have hundreds and hundreds of clients. They're hedge funds and institutional investors and banks. They're big multinational corporations. They're developed governments, including here in the UK. You know, it's basically anyone that is concerned about or impacted by the way that politics affects global markets. You know, political scientists, when I finished my PhD, they basically tell you, well, you can go into academe or you can go into government and be a policy think tank or something like that. I was like, well, what if you want to go into the private sector? And the response was, well, then why did you get a PhD? Well, I mean, there are economists in the private sector and there are all sorts of strategists. There are physicists who do chaos modeling for derivatives and the rest. If you're someone that believes that emerging markets are places that are becoming more important, and yet they're places where politics matter at least as much as economics for market outcomes, if you're concerned about the geopolitical shifts that are happening that are so historic, this creative destruction that we're seeing right now, think about where natural resources are coming from and the importance of resource nationalism, political scientists have a lot to say about that. And so basically I set about creating the political science company, and that's really what we do.
And have you found that there's been more of a market for your work as, you know, say, newspapers have cut the number of correspondents, as universities have sort of cut the budgets for their political science departments, that there's nowhere else that people can come to for this sort of information?
Well, I mean, look, the Financial Times and The Economist are still very good publications. And I mean, if you are in a business and you're global in orientation, you should be reading those. I don't think that their coverage has slipped definably. I think a lot of lower end places have cut. But that's not really a competitor with our organization, in the sense that, you know, if you read the FT, it's really interesting. It's 50,000 foot view. They're not the ones that are going to actually give you the kind of actionable analysis and support for an individual investment decision for a problem you're experiencing on the ground in a country. I think they're sort of apples and grapefruit, but I like grapefruit.
Okay, good. Yeah. We like grapefruit too. We're going to have to leave it there. Ian Bremmer, thank you very much indeed. The book is Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World. We're going to play another song now. This is Aluna George.
Our next guest is a journalist and author whose previous takes on self-improvement include learning the entire Encyclopedia Britannica and living by the exact word of the Bible for a year. In his new book, Drop Dead Healthy, writer AJ Jacobs vowed to become the healthiest man on earth. To tell us whether he got there, he's on the line now from New York. AJ, a very warm welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Now, tell us, how did this epic project start?
Well, it started about 3 years ago, and I was in terrible shape. I was what they call skinny fat. I don't know if you've ever heard that term, but it's sort of the body of a snake that had swallowed a goat. So I had quite a stomach. And then I was hospitalized with pneumonia, and my wife said to me, I don't want to be a widow in my 40s. You've got to get in shape. And so I thought, if I'm going to do this, I'll do it like my other books. I'm going to go all in and try to revamp every part of my health, from diet, exercise, sleep, stress level, sex life, posture, you name it. So that's what I did.
So you broke it down sort of anatomically almost into 27 chapters. And which one do you think was the most difficult? I mean, you specified so amazingly, from the teeth to the feet to the lungs to the eyes, to your sex life. Which episode was the most difficult and challenging?
Well, I think the heart certainly was hard, because that was exercise and I was not used to exercise. Another challenging thing was just the sheer number of things that I had to do every day. Because if you're following all of the health advice of doctors, then you basically have to quit your job and just do that. Because every day is filled with, you got to exercise, meditate, that's good for you, put on sunscreen, you go pet dogs. Petting dogs has known benefits, lowers your blood pressure. And I don't have a dog, so I would go out to the local dog park and pet strangers' dogs, which sometimes...
Is that a bit weird?
Yeah, sometimes they were a little...
I mean, I don't mean to be rude, but, you know, if you just came up to my dog and started petting it, it would be a bit funny.
Well, I would ask permission. It wasn't like I would do it without...
Oh, okay. Would you tell them you're doing it for health reasons?
I did. And sometimes they were receptive.
So tell us, did it work? I mean, you spent all this time, and it's an amazing effort, and it's detailed so wittily, but do you have a washboard stomach and abs to die for?
Well, it worked in that I feel better than I've ever felt before. I hate to say I'm the healthiest person alive, because as soon as I say that, then tomorrow I'll get some horrible disease. I'll get rickets or river blindness. So I try not to say that. But yes, I do feel great, and all the numbers went in the right direction. I do have abs, but they're kind of hiding. They're a little bit hiding.
Well, as long as you've got them a little bit, then that's important. AJ, I want to know some specifics, some details, because I fear I'm heading down a similar path. I'm more worried I'm going to look like a pregnant stick insect, which
there
is a sort
go.
Of... A, exactly, which is similar to a snake you know, swallowing a goat, I think. Can you give us an idea of what your daily schedule was actually like when you were doing this?
Absolutely. You've got, I tried to exercise every day. I tried to. Well, one thing I learned was that sitting at your desk all day is terrible for your health. One doctor told me, sitting is the new smoking, which is a bit of an overstatement, but not much. It's just horror. It wreaks havoc on your heart. So every day I would start my writing day. I had a treadmill, and I put my computer on top of the treadmill, and I would write while walking. So it took me about 1,200 miles to write the book. But that was a huge change. So I spent a lot of time walking. And also, in terms of exercise, I tried to fit exercise into every nook and cranny of my day. So, you know, the obvious one is to take the stairs instead of the elevator. But also, I ran errands. That's the phrase, run errands. So I thought, why not try it? So I would run to the pharmacy and buy a toothpaste and run back.
As Sophie said before in her intro, it's not the first of these kind of really immersive projects that you've taken on. I was interested to see that you've lived according to the values of the Bible for a year before as well. But I was wondering, with this project, did you kind of start to see similarities or draw parallels between the kind of religious values that you were living by under this previous one on the Bible with this kind of cult of wellness and health that everyone seems to be following so strictly now?
That's true. I did see some cult. And I think you've got some extremists and fundamentalists in both areas. You know, I'm in favor of moderation. So I think religious moderation is good and health moderation is good. But, you know, you run into the same passion and same, these people who will say, our way is the only way. Follow the caveman diet or you are
what was
going
some
to
of the,
die.
Yeah, what were some of the examples of that? What's the kind of the biggest crazy that you came across?
Well, there are the paleo movement is definitely, I think the paleo movement has some validity, but they're extremists. These are the people who believe we should be eating and exercising like cavemen. And, the hardcore extremists said we can't cook our food. We have to eat raw meat or insects. This one guy ate a lot of insects. I love this character. He did not believe in modern hygiene products because they were unhealthy. So no deodorant, no toothpaste. And he also complained that there are not enough women in the caveman movement. And I didn't want to be rude and point out there might be some causal connection between the lack of hygiene and the lack of women. But it occurs to me there might be.
I wonder what you make of the radical spectrum of the actual exercise that you did. I mean, I see here that you're a fan of the Wii and you strained your shoulder kayaking on Wii. But did you do any really punishing exercise that you can share with us?
Well, I did. I did a triathlon, and I tested out every possible exercise regimen I could. So that included pole dancing, which is very, I don't know if it's popular in the UK, but it's very popular
in certain
popular
places,
here.
Yes.
Yes?
Well, in certain clubs.
Yeah.
Recreationally.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't think many people have it in their living room, but, well, I mean, no one I know. Jonathan?
No, not my guy. Okay.
It's very aerobic.
Sophie's staying quiet. Sophie hasn't piped up yet.
There are some people that do it in a non-club environment. Let's put it like that.
Yep, the pole dancers I ran into were very serious and said that it had nothing to do with strip clubs. Aside from the fact that 95% does take place in strip clubs, that's the technicality. But they say it's a legitimate form of exercise. So you got to try it. It takes a lot of upper body strength. It's not easy.
I think we'll have to just take your word for that, AJ.
Okay.
I'm fairly sure around this table we're not going to be pole dancing. But AJ Jacobs, thank you very much indeed. The book is Drop Dead Healthy. We're going to play a song now, and it's sort of linked-ish, you could sort of say, the title. It's Jamie Liddell, and it's A Little Bit of Feel Good.
Just the sound.
just had to wait to the very end of that final little bit of was that saxophone? Do you think at the end of that?
I was going to say trumpet.
Trumpet.
But I was going to say the final toot anyway.
I'm quite surprised Sophie hasn't said, that's why you're foreign editor.
I was stifling that comment.
That was a little bit of Jamie Liddell with a little bit of Feel Good.
Time for our next guest now, and President Obama's announcement this week that he's in favour of gay marriage came just days after North Carolina controversially banned the institution, making it a hot topic at home and abroad. One person who knows the temperamental challenges of reporting sensitive issues in the US is editor of online news and commentary site The All, Kaya Seeker. He joins us on the line now to tell us how Americans are reacting. Kaya, hello.
Oh, hi. How are you all?
Very well, thank you. So this is being celebrated as something of a coming out party for Obama. I wonder, what's your take on it? Are you joining the party?
well, we always love an excuse for a party. It's a funny time. Everyone's actually seems very conflicted. It's on the one hand, it's a very amazing thing for him to just come and say. And on the other hand, it feels with the one of the votes in North Carolina this week, it feels like a little bit of awkward timing, perhaps a day late and maybe a dollar short.
I mean, he's very famously called his developing public policies, at least on gay marriage, an evolution. And it's almost he talks of it in terms of as a personal development for him. I know that you've been following it a lot on The All, sometimes quite kind of spikily. What's your actual take on how much do you think this is a personal behind the scenes conversion for Obama, the man, and how much do you think it's a move by the administration?
I think it's a funny, I think it's actually very personal on his part. My perception is that he fought with this for a long time, you know, as a Christian, and had previously been very frank about the fact that as a Christian, he couldn't actually endorse gay marriage, even as he was very supportive about anti-discrimination. But his talking about it was also very personal because the president's job in the United States, it's a bully pulpit. It actually doesn't have a lot of power. He can do a number of things, and previous administrations tried to make the office more powerful, but the president doesn't have a lot to do in the U.S. So when he talks about this, he didn't come, you know, out with a hammer saying, you know, I want to push the United States in this direction. He talked about it in really personal terms.
Kai, I mean, you touched on it there in a sense in terms of what's actually changed, which in a sense, nothing has changed because, you know, President Obama has said, although he personally believes that, same-sex relationships should be able to be marriages as well, he's also said this is a decision for individual states, so there's going to be no change in the law. But, I mean, some commentators are also saying that this is actually culturally such a big shift that there is a president who says, yes, it's quite all right for you to be gay and get married. I mean, which side of that do you come down on?
I'm in a funny boat. I'm married to a man in New York State, and I live most of the year in Florida where I'm not married. So it's not a huge deal, but if one of us is in the hospital, it's a huge deal. If we are enacting a new lease for an apartment, it's a big deal. And so on the one hand, it's sort of thrilling. It's a thing. It's just another one of those amazing things that happens where you would not have ever thought, oh, someday there'll be a mixed race, you know, black identified U.S. president talking about how he supports gay marriage. Like, that's not a thing we thought about in the 80s, right?
Well, indeed.
Obviously the people who are going to vote Obama anyway, maybe they're not going to be swayed by this. But do you think actually, you know, getting serious about it, is this a moment where Republicans might be rubbing their hands in glee, because there are a lot of swing voters who maybe politically would be affiliated with Obama, but actually they have real deep-seated religious convictions that aren't, you know, you shouldn't really just dismiss as bigotry, but that it's actually at odds with their religious convictions to follow someone who has come out in support of this union.
Yeah, I think if you look at it politically, and my theory is that this is sort of a ploy to differentiate the presumptive Republican candidate Mitt Romney from Obama. He can say, he sort of forced Mitt Romney in this position where he actually could barely stand to answer the question he was now being asked about gay marriage, and then was answering it rather poorly. So it's forcing a, you know, a cleaver there in the actual social beliefs of the two different candidates, which is actually a useful strategy, I feel like. It makes it really clear that you're voting for someone really socially conservative, actually, whereas Mitt Romney was like, I was the governor of Massachusetts, a very liberal state. You know, I can get along with liberals. And then when he can't escape his fundamental Republican-endorsed position against things like gay marriage.
Kaya Seeker, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. That's it, guys. We've come to the end.
Not fast.
The very end of the weekly roadshow.
That was fun.
It was, wasn't
Thanks,
it?
Thanks, guys.
Way to spend Sunday morning. Didn't get any food in this week, though.
No, no, don't worry. But we can have food afterwards. Now we go for lunch.
Normally, we get burgers and stuff in for the Monocle Weekly, don't we? We had wine, actually, last time we all did it together. Which
that
is a bit of a
true.
Slushy way to spend a Sunday.
It is. It is. Yeah. Sadly, there was no alcoholic beverage of any description this time, apart from the orange juices that we had as a sort of a Sunday brunch type thing.
But lots of food for thought, geopolitics, all of that jazz.
Oh, I like that. Nice little link there.
Good work, Sophie.
Yeah. And should we can have another song as well, if you really want. We could end with a song.
I'd like one, please.
Would you?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'm afraid there's no tenuous link that I can make between this song and anything else we have. I'll just have to announce
Gay
it.
Gay marriage.
No, there's nothing really. Anyway, the show was produced by, I think we've mentioned his name enough already today. I think we don't need to mention it again. It was Paul Noble who produced it. Researcher was Tom Hall. The Weekly will be back at the same time next week. Maybe with the same people, maybe with a different cast. Who knows? Till then, we'll be playing you out with Lucy Lee by Sean Lee. For now, from all of us here at Monocle 24, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
I'm Sophie Grove.
And I'm Jonathan Openshaw.
Goodbye.